Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. This is Crime Talk, and my name is Scott Reich. A quick preview for today's docket. First, a hearing in the Lori Vallow-Chad Daybell matter. Will there be two trials or one? I'll explain that and what I think will happen. Second, a quick recap of the testimony in the Depp Heard matters. You always have to wait till the other plaintiff presents their case now, don't you? Next, an indictment comes down against Peyton Gendron in state court. Will the federal courts follow? A study that may surprise you, but didn't really surprise me. Shockingly, another person who loves kids is arrested. And then finally, our dumb criminal of the day with a bonus contestant today. Let's talk about it. Good day, everyone. You know the drill. Subscribe if you have not. Like the video if you do. Leave me a comment. Hit that bell so you get notifications. And remember, if you cannot watch us here on Facebook, you can always listen to us on your favorite podcasting app by searching Crime Talk with Scott Reich. Before we get to today's docket, let's support the sponsors that help support the channel. Today, it's crimetalksearch.com. That is a background subscription service where you can do a background search on anyone in the United States and get the search results literally within minutes while you wait. The report you will receive is a report showing emails associated with a person and social media accounts related to a person. You'll receive a criminal background check, which will show arrests and convictions. The report will show if someone is on a sex offender registry, property records, civil judgments, also divorce records in most states. Now, if you're meeting someone new or don't feel that maybe that new someone is telling you everything, go check them out. Do not become a victim. It is dating malpractice not to check that new someone out these days. Maybe the kids, you know, new boyfriend or girlfriend, and your spidey senses are tingling that something just isn't right. Check them out. Go to crimetalksearch.com. We use this in our law practice every day, and we're always surprised on things that we find out. People just don't tell you their secrets, ladies and gentlemen. Go to crimetalksearch.com and find them out. Let's go ahead and open the record for Thursday, May 19th, 2022. Will there be one trial or two trials when it comes to Chad Daybell and Lori Vallow? For those of you who are not familiar with the case, let me explain. For those who are familiar with the case, let's just be patient for a second. This is important information as it relates to the motion to continue the trial of Lori Vallow outside of speedy trial. So on April 16th of 2021, a grand jury was convened in Fremont County, Idaho. And on May 24th, 2021, the grand jury returned a joint indictment against the defendants, Chad Daybell and Lori Vallow, containing a total of 9 criminal charges relating to the murders of Tylee Ryan, J.J. Vallow, and Tamara Daybell. Specifically, the indictment charges both defendants with one count of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder and grand theft by deception, wherein Tylee Ryan is one of the victims, one count of first-degree murder wherein Tylee Ryan is the victim, one count of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder, and grand theft by deception wherein J.J. Vallow is the victim. One count of first-degree murder, where J.J. Vallow is the victim, and one count of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder, wherein Tammy Daybell is the victim. In addition, defendant Lori Vallow is charged with one count of grand theft, wherein the United States government is the victim due to Lori Vallow receiving Social Security funds intended for the care of Tylee Ryan and J.J. Vallow. Defendant Chad Daybell has additional charges of one count of first-degree murder, wherein Tamara Daybell was the victim, and two counts of insurance fraud for the receipt of life insurance proceeds for Tammy Daybell's death. Now, upon motion from the defense, and the prosecution confessed this motion, which is basically said, we agree, The court ultimately entered an order for competency evaluation on March 8th of 2021 for Lori Vallow. And following its review of the psychological assessment, the court determined that the defendant was incompetent to stand trial on June 8th of 2021 and on June 9th of 2021. And this court entered an order staying Lori Vallow's case pursuant to the finding of incompetency and commitment to the State Department of Health. Now, on September 22nd, 2021, an order for extended commitment was entered following a progress report from the state hospital on the restoration efforts. And on April 11th, 2022, this court entered an order finding that the defendant, Lori Vallow, fit to proceed and lifted the previously entered stay on the proceedings. On April 19th of 2022, defendant Lori Vallow was arraigned and pursuant to her request for a trial setting within statutory speedy trial limits, her case, along with her co-defendant, Chad DeBell, was set for trial commencing on October 11th, 2022. Now, you have to remember, criminal cases are governed by the Constitution as well as statutory considerations when it comes to speedy trial rights. And specifically in Idaho, as this particular case is taking place. So the Sixth Amendment guarantees the right to a speedy trial in the United States Constitution and Article 1, Section 13 of the Idaho Constitution. And these constitutional protections are supplemented by the Idaho Code, specifically Section 19-3501, which sets specific time limits within which a criminal defendant must be brought to trial. And the relevant part of the Idaho Code provides that the court, in this particular case, Lori Vallow's court, must order that a prosecution or indictment be dismissed if not brought to trial within 6 months, unless good cause is shown to the contrary. Now, the state bears the burden of demonstrating that good cause exists for the delay of a trial beyond the six-month statutory prescribed time period. Now, the United States Supreme Court, in a case called Barker v. Wingo, decided back in 1972, laid out a test whether a defendant's right to a speedy trial has been deprived. The first thing the United States Supreme Court says is you have to look at is the length of the delay. Well, if you're a defendant in custody, 1 day beyond your six-month speedy trial right is too long. That's what the defense will argue. Second, the reason for the delay. Is it a short delay because a necessary witness is in the hospital but will be released next week? Probably going to be a reasonable delay. Next, whether the defendant asserted the right to a speedy trial. Here, we know Lori Vallow said, "I'm not waiving my right to speedy trial." And then the next thing is the prejudice to the defendant. All right, so there you go. The length of the delay, the reason for the delay, whether the defendant asserted the right to a speedy trial, and then prejudice to the defendant. The Supreme Court has also said in the analysis for determining if there was a violation of speedy trial rights, first, the length of the delay is a triggering mechanism. Okay. Next, unless there is a delay that is presumptively prejudicial, which means it was weeks, months, years, you just dismiss the case. If that's the case, then you don't have to go into an analysis as it relates to those remaining factors. However, the nature of the case is also relevant in determining the period of delay that can be tolerated under Idaho case law. For the period that is reasonable for the prosecution of an ordinary street crime is considerably less than for a complex conspiracy charge. And the courts have looked at the reason for the delay in relation to unavailable witnesses, newly discovered evidence, or issues that arise much closer in proximity to the trial date. Here, we don't have a trial date for several months. And the defendant's assertion of his or her right to a speedy trial is entitled to a strong evidentiary weight in determining whether the defendant is being deprived of that right. Now, Lori Vallow has clearly affirmatively asserted her right to speedy trial in this particular case. So the question then becomes, what is the court going to do? And the court noted in the hearing today, you have the statutory speedy trial right, which is the 6 months, And then you have a constitutional speedy trial right. And the court wanted to know, is it the same analysis? The prosecution said it's the same analysis. And you would have thought that the prosecution was arguing for Lori Vallow today, basically saying, hey, her attorneys need more time. This is a complex case. They really need to be prepared. You would have thought that they were Lori Vallow's attorneys. Lori Vallow's attorneys are basically like, my client, I've talked to her as recently as yesterday. She doesn't want to waive her right to speedy trial, and she wants to go forward, understanding that they may not be adequately prepared. That's the duty of the attorney, to be prepared within that 6-month time period. They better drop everything and start working on this case. So what is the court going to do? Clearly, statutorily, 6 months, exception for short delays. What's the nature of it? Then you have the other option that the court could continue it out, maybe move Chad DeBell's trial back. They could possibly do that, but Chad DeBell is objecting to that because he thinks that he needs that time, or his attorney does, to be prepared. The other option is the court just says, we're going to do 2 separate trials. Okay. And why is that important? It is important because if the court comes up with an analysis and says that there is sufficient reason to set this trial outside of the 6-month statutory speedy trial date, and the court is wrong and it goes up on appeal, all charges could be dismissed as it relates to Lori Vallow. What court is going to want to take that risk? I can't think of many. I'm not a judge. I don't play one on TV. But I think the court is going to really do one of two options. Say we're going to do 2 trials or move Chad DeBell's trial back to October instead of beginning that trial on January 9th of 2023. I think the judge would be foolhardy to try and come up with some sort of analysis to continue the case for at least 4 months. We're not talking a couple of days or even a couple of weeks. 4 months. I think that's just a little too long. Judge Boyce stated that he would issue a ruling sooner rather than later. Hopefully it's sooner, because obviously everybody needs to know how to prepare. I mean, think about it. The prosecution needs to know what to prepare for. Oh, and this is the thing that really shocked me. Sorry to forget this, ladies and gentlemen. We're just going to talk about this. The district attorney's office said they still haven't tested several items of DNA. Now, I get it. If we tested every piece of evidence in every case, the DNA labs would be completely backed up. But this is a pretty big case by the district attorney's own statements. Why are they waiting until the matter's been set for trial to do the testing? They've known this is a death penalty case. They know that it's going to go to trial. Why are they waiting? They've had 2.5 years, ladies and gentlemen. I'm getting a little concerned that maybe the prosecution is in a little over their heads when it comes to this particular case. They seem to be on their heels at every step of the way. And that only plays in favor of 2 people, Lori Vallow and Chad DeBell. Next on the docket, Depp versus Heard. That's right. The trial of Johnny Depp and Amber Heard continues again today. And they started a little late because a juror showed up a little late. It happens. Every now and then, jurors get stuck in traffic. There's a childcare emergency. They oversleep. It happens. They're humans. But guess what? They can't start without that juror until they show up. And if the juror just didn't show up, then they usually use an alternate. So not the case, but we'll see if that juror has future issues as the days go by. So who testified today? Well, Johnny Depp's ex-friend, I always like how the ex-friend, Bruce Witkin, said he observed a bruise on Amber Heard's arm once, but didn't know how she received the bruise. He said that Depp's drug addiction became increasingly out of control, and he was once asked to find him, referring to Johnny Depp, while he was on a bender with Marilyn Manson. It's deep-rooted issues he's dealing with, he said. It has nothing to do with Amber. The attorney asked Mr. Witkin what his relationship is with Mr. Depp now, and he said the actor completely cut him off in 2018 without explanation after being deposed and testified about Johnny Depp's drug use. Also testifying this morning was Johnny Depp's former talent agent, whom he fired in October of 2016. Tracy Jacobs said that by the time she was fired, his star, referring to Johnny Depp, had dimmed due to it getting harder to get him jobs due to his lateness and other things. During the last decade of their professional relationship, Depp became more challenging to work with due to his unprofessional behavior. She added that he began abusing alcohol and drugs with greater frequency, and Ms. Jacobs said she didn't know why Depp fired her. Now, Johnny Depp's former business manager, a guy by the name of Joel Mandel, described his spending habits, referring to Mr. Depp's, as, quote, excessive consumption, end quote, including blowing more than $300,000 a month on three full-time assistants. Now, Mr. Depp fired and sued Mr. Mandel in 2017 for allegedly stealing millions of dollars from him. Mandel said in the pre-recorded deposition played for jurors this Thursday that Mr. Depp had prolific spending habits and required incredibly high income to be maintained. The actor paid addiction doctor David Kipper and his medical entourage over $100,000 a month. Mandel testified that he spent three full-time assistants on with $300,000 a month and his late head of security, Jerry Judge, $10,000 a day. It has previously been reported that Depp spent nearly $2 million a month in 2015 to maintain his extravagant lifestyle. Next to testify was Amber Waldman, Johnny Depp's lawyer, who Amber Heard accused of helping Depp launch a smear campaign against her. In Waldman's pre-recorded testimony, which was still under oath, and who is still Johnny Depp's attorney, dodged most of the questions from the attorneys due to attorney-client privilege. The attorneys for Ms. Heard couldn't elicit an answer from Mr. Waldman on whether Depp told him to issue the three statements to the media in 2020, accusing Heard of lying about the abuse. Heard's team must show that Depp was behind Waldman's statements to prove their defamation case. You know, it gets into a weird area of attorney-client privilege. You waive it to one question. Do you waive it to all questions? But when you can't answer, it's kind of like taking the fifth, isn't it? Next, a pre-recorded deposition from Detective Maria Sadanga said that the patrol officers who responded to Amber Heard's penthouse apartment on May 21st, 2016, should have filled out a domestic violence incident report. Police were called to the apartment after Depp allegedly smashed Heard's face with a cell phone. In pre-recorded depositions, the two responding officers testified that they observed no injuries on Heard and closed the call as a verbal dispute. Another set of officers showed up several hours later after receiving a second 911 call over the same incident, and they also testified that Heard had no injuries. Now, Heard went to a Los Angeles courtroom 6 days later with a visible bruise under her right eye and obtained a restraining order against Johnny Depp, citing the cell phone fight. And forensic social media expert Ron Schnell testified that negative hashtags related to Amber Heard spiked after Johnny Depp's lawyer allegedly defamed her in statements to the press. Attorney Adam Waldman called her allegations an abusive hoax in statements in the press in 2020. Schnell analyzed negative tweets about Heard from April 20 to January 2021 and found approximately 2.28 million. A majority of them used the hashtag AmberTurd or "We just don't like you, Amber." Amber Heard is an abuser and justice for Johnny Depp. He testified that over 25% of the tweets contained the term Waldman or Wald Minion. Heard's team has accused Depp and his attorney of launching a smear campaign against her. On cross-examination, Mr. Schnell conceded that he could not definitively tie the negative tweets to Waldman's statements. And in a pre-recorded deposition of Ellen Barkin from November of 2019, and Barkin and Depp had a romantic relationship turned sexual in 1994 for about 3 to 6 months. Ms. Barkin said Depp was always drinking or smoking a joint and often took hallucinogenics and did cocaine. She said that Depp was extremely controlling and jealous and even threw a wine bottle across a hotel room in Las Vegas in her direction and it hit the wall. Psychiatrist Dr. Alan Blaunstein had 14 sessions with Depp in 2014 and said Depp had patience, anxiety, and anger issues. He described Depp's relationship with Heard as chaotic and high intensity. Blaunstein read from his notes and said that Depp called his relationship with Heard and Vanessa Paradise, the mother of his children, as characterized by rage and chaos. Never a dull moment in the Heard case, but at least the witnesses are moving along much, much faster. But now you can see, ladies and gentlemen, this is why you have to reserve judgment until you hear all the evidence in the case. And remember, as I've said it, and people don't like it, the jury believes that Ms. Heard was the victim of one incident of domestic violence. Johnny Depp's defamation claim fails. Now, we heard today in the case in chief of Ms. Heard that Johnny Depp was doing a pretty good job of ruining his career on his own. And then the issue of whether Amber Heard can prove up her claim of damages for the defamation against her in the amount of $100 million seems a little weak. But hey, we'll see what the jury wants to do with it. Next on the docket, Peyton Gendron. So Peyton Gendron, the 18-year-old accused of murdering 10 people at a supermarket in Buffalo, sat silent after being indicted by grand juries for first-degree murder. He apparently sat silent during the proceedings while victim family members yelled out, "Peyton, you're a coward." And the first-degree murder indictment covering all 10 deaths was handed up Wednesday. And the assistant district attorney announced this in court. Now, in New York, prosecutors can charge a defendant with first-degree murder only under exceptional circumstances, including when multiple people are killed in a single incident. The single count against Gendron covers all 10 deaths of Top Friendly's Market in Buffalo. No domestic terror charges have been filed in federal court at this time, and Gendron will be back in court on June 9th at 9:30 a.m., and he's being held without bail. We'll see if those federal charges come down soon. Okay, teachers. For those of you keeping track at home, at least 135 teachers and teachers' aides have been arrested this year so far for child sex-related crimes. And it seems like we've covered all 135. It's overwhelming. The analysis found that at least 135 educators have been arrested in 41 states between January and May 13th of this year, which works out to about an arrest a day on average. 76% of the arrested educators were men, and of the 135, at least 102 involved students. To name a few, on April 11th, police in California charged Anthony James Phillips, a 61-year-old former teacher at Cupertino Middle School in Sunnyvale, with aggravated sexual assault of a child, forcible penetration with a foreign object, and forcible penetration with a foreign object upon a child. Anessa Page Gower, a 35-year-old former biology teacher at the Making Waves Academy in Richmond, California, was charged with 29 counts of child molestation on April 8th. Who can forget William Landon Smith, a 31-year-old former science teacher at Cape Fear High School in Fayetteville, North Carolina, was charged with 27 counts of first-degree sexual exploitation of a minor, 28 counts of indecent liberties with a student, and one count of secretly using or installing a photographic imaging device to arouse or gratify sexual desire back on March 18th. Then we got John Dottie, a 35-year-old former biology teacher at Career Academy South Bend in Indiana. He was charged with two counts of sexual assault, one count of attempted sexual assault, and six counts of child seduction back on February 9th. And Dottie is accused of repeatedly sexually assaulting a 16-year-old female student and threatening to kill her. A 29-year-old former substitute teacher in the Roxanne and Alton County School Districts, Daniel Fisher, was charged with criminal sexual assault and aggravated criminal sexual abuse on February 4th. Fisher was accused of sexually assaulting two teenage male students at her home in Edwardsville during the summer break last year. And a Madison County grand jury later added child pornography to the charges. And most recently, a Pennsylvania high school choir director was accused of having an inappropriate relationship with a 17-year-old female student after her husband learned of the relationship and reported it to the officials. The 17-year-old student admitted to being involved with Ms. Ortz and said she trusted and confided in her. The criminal complaint states that Ms. Ortz invited the girl home while her husband was away, and they snuggled while watching television and then retired to the bedroom for a little bit of sexual activity. Now, Olivia Ortz, 26, has been charged with two counts of sexual contact with a student, one count of unlawful contact with a minor for sexual offenses, and criminal use of a communication facility. Ms. Ortz had to turn herself in on Monday after singing in the Chenango Valley Chorale 50th anniversary concert. She was arraigned and ordered to be held on a $150,000 bond, which she posted. And the ultimate irony of all this is that Ms. Ortz replaced Jonathan Priano as choir director at the school after he was accused of misconduct with various students back in June of 2020. His pretrial date has been set for June 29th. You can't make this stuff up, ladies and gentlemen, and I don't know what to tell you, but there's some people, I guess, that want to be teachers to truly help the children, and then there's other people there that truly want to touch the children. So you got to be careful, okay? And let's face it, none of my teachers ever asked me to come on over to their house and snuggle. And if somebody did that with my kids, I assure you, the police would have been the first people called. All right, next, kids matter. Yes, they do. And the vice president of the Naperville, Illinois-based charity Kids Matter and senior business banker Eric Kroll has been arrested and faces multiple charges related to possessing inappropriate images of minors. Now, Kids Matters focuses on preventive strategies to ensure that young people avoid destructive behavior, according to its website. And authorities were able to gather enough evidence online to execute a search warrant of Kroll's residence before he was arrested. And according to the police officers, a forensic examination of Mr. Kroll's digital electronics revealed the presence of inappropriate child pictures, ladies and gentlemen. Well, the DuPont County State's Attorney said the allegations against Kroll were alarming, primarily since he currently serves as the vice president of the board of Kids Matters. Berlin did not want to stress that the allegations against Mr. Krill are in no way affiliated with Kid Matters, and Kroll's next court date is scheduled for 9 a.m. on June 18th. You know, ladies and gentlemen, some people love kids. They're going to do anything they can to be around kids. You got to check them out. Okay? Check them out. Some people like to be love animals. They do everything they can to be around animals. They love animals. Let's hope they're not loving animals, but, you know, love animals. I'm just telling you, you got to be careful out there. Okay? Just be careful. And next, our dumb criminal. Today, a bonus feature. An Amish man was arrested for running his horse and buggy into a police car at 2:30 in the morning in Orwell, Ohio. Now, police responded to a call about a horse and buggy swerving in the streets, and while trying to pull the buggy over in a low-speed chase slash pit maneuver, one of the officers says that they noticed a Bud Light can sitting there, and the buggy passenger was passed out. He got drunk. Apparently, the Amish guy did in the buggy. And the video, as you can see, shows the buggy hitting the police cruiser, causing the driver to be ejected from the buggy. I'm sure the Amish driver will sue the police for not buckling him in. The Amish man has been identified as Nathan Miller. He refused to the sobriety test, but later registered a .063 on a breathalyzer. He's been charged with operating a vehicle intoxicated. Little learning point here, ladies and gentlemen. You can be charged with intoxication on a horse, riding a bike, a boat, anything that's motorized, unless it specifically says, like some states, nothing under a 50cc little moped or something. But for the most part, 8 hours from bottle to throttle. Remember that. Good advice. Could save you lots of money in attorney's fees. And then we have Angela Davis in our doubleheader today, who was arrested for allegedly beating her husband with a belt after she caught him watching pornography on his cell phone and pleasuring himself. Now, Davis's husband said that he had got into an altercation with his wife after she interrupted his pleasure session, and after Davis wrapped a leather belt with a large metal buckle around her fist, the dispute allegedly got a little more violent. Some of our dumb criminals wouldn't call that violent. They would call it foreplay. Well, the victim told cops that when he took out his phone to dial 911, Davis knocked the device from his hand and struck him several times with the belt on his arms and back. Miss Davis claimed she grabbed the belt to protect herself. The cops determined her to be the primary aggressor in the incident. She was charged with aggravated battery and witness tampering. She was freed from the Marion County Jail after posting a $1,000 bond and is scheduled back in court on June 14th. No doubt there'd be a protection order, and now her husband can do whatever he wants on his phone since he has no contact with his wife. All right, that's all we have for you, ladies and gentlemen. I know it was kind of a long show. Hopefully you stuck with us. Hopefully it was worth it to you. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk.